Hello everyone and welcome to RadChat, the multi-award winning first therapeutic radiographer-led oncology podcast. Welcome to a bonus series in paid collaboration with Elekta, who are a global company that provide radiotherapy and radiosurgery treatment solutions for cancer care. My name is Mamanjoka Anderson and I'm joined by fellow host Joe McNamara.
Hi everyone.
So a big thank you to our last guest, Renee Joss, who discussed her career, radiographer-led working and technical advances in neuro-oncology. If you haven't had a chance yet, please do go and take a listen. So we're very pleased to introduce our guest all the way from the other side of the world, Dr. Matt Foote, who will be discussing his career as a radiation oncologist, the integration of Gamma Knife and health inequalities. Hi, Matt. How are you?
Very well, Naman and Joe. Thank you for the invitation and welcome to all your listeners.
Thanks, Matt. Would you mind by starting and telling us about your current role and how you got there?
Well, I have a few roles. I guess, firstly, just to give you a bit of background, my practice includes part-time public, part-time private, as well as an administrative role in both of those. So in my public post, I'm the director of the Gamma Knife Centre of Queensland, which was the first public Gamma Knife in Australia. And there I'm 50% clinical, but obviously have a bit of administrative role. In terms of how I got there, I actually did a fellowship in Canada at Princess Margaret and saw the use of a Gamma Knife there and thought that there was a void in Australia in terms of that technology. And so on my return, basically wrote the business plans and really lobbied hard to get Gamma Knife into Australia. We've now been treating for almost 10 years now. So it was certainly a significant amount of body of work prior to getting it in, but now probably a very established Gamma Knife Centre in Brisbane. In terms of my private work, I'm the Deputy Director of Radiation Oncology for ICON Group. ICON Group is the largest provider of private cancer care in Australia. We've actually also now got a significant interest overseas with centres in New Zealand, Singapore, Hong Kong, China, Malaysia, and actually just moving into the UK as of this year. I have a private practice within ICON where I treat at a number of their centres. And in my role as deputy director, I'm involved in strategic planning in terms of centres and technology and also some recruitment. So for me, I think it's an interesting career in the sense that I've got a good mix of public, private, admin roles, which often lead into mentoring roles as well. So very happy with the mix of work that I have at the moment.
Matt, when do you find time to sleep?
Look, I think it takes time to manage practice and admin roles, life in general. I think I've had to develop very good time management skills, and I think management skills in general, and I guess all people that have mid to high level management roles understand that you need to control the things that you can control and not spend time on the things you can't, and learn to focus efforts where they're most needed at a given time. So it's certainly been a process of me learning as to how to manage my time over many years.
Matt, I'm going to take you back very quickly. Why do you like oncology? Why healthcare?
Yeah, look, I think it's... You'd think it would be a simple question, but it's actually not. I guess when I look back at my early career as a doctor, I really enjoyed radiology, technology, but I also wanted to do something where I was interacting with patients. And I was very fortunate in my early career to speak to someone who had an interest in radiation oncology. And to me, it just seemed to tick many of those boxes. One thing I did do, and the advice that I give to all junior doctors that are in a similar position, is it's always worthwhile speaking to people very senior in that specialty and ask them, if you had your time again, would you do anything different? And every radiation oncologist that I spoke to when I was working out whether or not this is what I wanted to do told me how much they love their job, that they would never do anything different. And it rings true for me now. I think I'm kind of mid-senior career. And with the eye of retrospect, I would not have changed anything in terms of my career path. I think it's an amazing specialty. with a great mix of many things and the ability to have great impact on patients' lives. And I think what's often lost is that real ability to work as part of a team. As you know, it's delivered really in a team environment, and that's something that I think is great, being able to work with a multidisciplinary team to achieve these goals of looking after our patients.
Matt, how many radiosurgery gamma knives are there now in Australia? Is that something that you've kind of introduced and then it's rolled out much more widely?
Yeah, so there was a private provider in Sydney before we brought the first public one into Brisbane. There is now one at the Peter MacCallum Institute or Cancer Centre in Melbourne. So there's now three gamma knives in Australia, two public, one private. There are certainly plans for potentially more gamma knives in Australia over the coming years. So, look, I think that certainly the success of the public gamma knife that we built in Brisbane has certainly enabled the growth of this technology through Australia.
Matt, what is the difference in Australia between public versus private healthcare?
There's a number of differences, and it's probably beyond the scope of this meeting today. I guess if we break it down from a radiation oncology perspective, one of the difficulties in Australia is ensuring that all people have access to not just radiation therapy, but the latest technology. The difficulty in Australia is we're such a geographically diverse country with, you know, huge land spaces, very spread out population, excepting that a lot of it's still on that eastern seaboard, you know, your Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane. So, you know, I think one of the issues is how do we get that access? And one way it has been approached is with public and private partnerships. So if you look at some of the regional centres, many of the regional centres are actually through a combination of private and public, which provide the service in that town. In the cities, we have both public and private. I have to say that many of the public centres do exceptional work. One of the issues is obviously in many healthcare jurisdictions that of resources and wait times. I think certainly in some public centres, there are significant times for patients to see their oncologist, time to get onto treatment. In private, that is not the case. I do see that they complement each other very well. The Australian healthcare system has always had that combination of public and private. And I think that there's that good mix where people that cannot afford to go public have a very good service in the public centre. And so it caters for the needs of our population. But I certainly think that the private really has stepped up to the mark in terms of enabling access to patients in more regional areas to services closer to home.
For anyone who does live geographically away from a centre, do you have then provisions for patients to stay over? I know obviously radiosurgery is typically completed in one single day. So does that kind of then preempt that would be the way forward to introduce more so that, you know, especially for any of those brain lesions, that potentially that's the treatment option that you would go for rather than maybe external beam radiotherapy?
Yeah, Joe, I think you've highlighted something really important there. And that was one of the ways that we managed to get our business plan over the line for Gamma Knife. We could show that for many patients, we could set up a statewide service where they could fly in, have their treatment on a given day and go home maybe the following day. So in many instances, even patients travelling from, you know, 1,000 miles away could come in, have their treatment and be back within 1 or 2 days. I guess it's not just that in terms of patients being away from family, but there's direct costs involved in terms of patients being away from work for extended periods of time. So certainly our Gamma Knife program, where we really enabled our more regional patients to have direct access through telehealth. So we would do telehealth consultations, then flying in maybe the day of or the day before their procedure, and then flying home same day or day after, was really important to enabling access to this service.
So Matt, you highlighted the fact that obviously in Australia there aren't maybe the access available to lots of patients. So how do you decide the eligibility of patients as to whether or not they receive stereotactic radiosurgery versus normal external beam radiotherapy?
Yeah, Joe, this is something that's evolved over time, and I think what was key early on is we got involvement by all key stakeholders around our state. We set up a multidisciplinary meeting where they could refer patients directly in, and we spend a lot of time feeding information back to referrers, not just for that information, but there's an education piece in that as well, and that over time, even our referrers start to work out this patient's better off treated with radiosurgery or Gamma Knife. This patient may be easier treated locally. So it certainly has taken a lot of time and ongoing education, liaising with referrers. But I think core to the decision making is our multidisciplinary meeting, which has a range of radiation specialists, neurosurgeons, often feeding into that are other specialists, whether that be ENT skull-based surgeons, sometimes even neurologists. And in that team, we also have our therapists, physicists, and nursing staff. So setting up that central core team that's involved in decision making, but involving all of the key stakeholders has been key to all of that.
Is there much difference between pre-operative and post-operative stereotactic radiosurgery?
Yeah, so this is an evolving field at the moment. I think probably where you're leading to is in that setting of secondary brain tumours or metastases. Now, if you look at many radiosurgery programs, particularly Gamma Knife, a significant proportion of the patients treated are those with brain metastases or secondary deposits from their primary tumour. Over time, in fact, through the course of my career, how we've treated patients with resected brain metastases, so those that require resection because they either need tissue diagnosis or they're large, causing pressure effects and symptoms. Previously, they used to have surgery, then whole brain treatment. That's moved beyond, and the evidence now is definitive that these patients are better off treated with a stereotactic bed boost. Moving on from that, many people were thinking, well, there may be some advantages by getting the radiation in sooner, that being the preoperative radiosurgery in patients that go on to have resection. Now, there's a lot of data, including our own presented and published data, which shows that there are some advantages of doing it preoperatively as opposed to doing surgery followed by cavity stereotactic treatment. Now, the caveat to that is it hasn't been proven in a randomized phase three study. I think those are in play. But there is evolving evidence to show that not only can it produce very good control rates, but there may be a reduced risk of other unwanted effects like radionecrosis or damage from radiation treatment. It may reduce the risk of dissemination through the CSF, that's called leptomeningeal disease. And one of the things that I think is probably worth highlighting is when we do a preoperative approach, we can often do radiosurgery in 24 hours or 2 days before their operation. Once they recover after their operation, they can get quickly back on to their drug therapy. So one of the major implications is reducing the time that patients are off their drug therapy. And many of us do know that response to drug therapy is often the thing that's going to influence their overall survival. So I think that is an important endpoint where we're looking at preoperative treatment. So from my perspective, I think our field is going to move towards pre-op to those lesions that are secondaries that require surgery. The caveat to that is the evidence isn't quite there to say it's a routine option. But as all of us know, that sometimes it does take a little while for the evidence to catch up with what is best practice.
What is the evidence that you need for that?
Oh, look, I think any of these things that are going to be practice changing do need to be tested in a randomized controlled trial. It gives us the highest level of evidence. The issue with this is there's a lot of nuance and difficulty in running these trials in terms of picking the best endpoint, how to power it, number of patients. And the reality of running trials is you need money to run trials, and there's always that funding aspect to it. So look, as much as it sounds simple that we should just run this randomized phase 3 trial, there's a lot of stuff in the background that can often make it a little bit more challenging than it may sound. But look, I think until we get that answer in that randomized phase 3 trial where half the people get randomized to cavity post-op, half get randomized to pre-op, we won't be able to sit here and say definitively this is the best way to go.
Elekta Esprit is a platform for the future, powerful, accurate, and reliable. It allows high patient throughput with flexible workflows to ensure each patient's treatment is personalized. You want to understand more about how the Gamma Knife can benefit a busy oncology department? Come and visit us at our booth at ASTRO in Glasgow this year between the 3rd and 7th of May. We look forward to seeing you there.
So Matt, for any patients that might be listening, what do you anticipate the side effects and maybe more so the late effects? Because we often, as radiation therapists, therapeutic radiographers, support patients with any impending side effects that they get through the treatment. But I would imagine for patients that are more geographically remote, it is more challenging to kind of deal with side effects and especially those long-term side effects as well in Australia.
Yeah, I agree. I think what I would say is that if we're looking at impacts on patients in many brain tumours, whether that be benign or malignant, we do know that the biggest impact for patients is uncontrolled tumour. So I think the caveat is, yes, there are side effects from treatment, both short and long term, but we would only be recommending treatment if we thought that that was outweighed by the benefit of treatment. In terms of managing patients over a wide geographic region, I agree that does create certain challenges, but I think our technology has enabled us in terms of how to manage that. Now, look, here we are doing a podcast with me in Brisbane, Australia, you in the UK, and you know, not only can we see each other, we can pick up the non-verbals, we can chat. There's a lot that you can get through these virtual mediums, and we certainly utilise that. Do I think that we lose much? I have to say, I think rarely do we lose a lot by managing our patients through virtual forums. I guess when I think about many brain conditions, I guess most of it can be done from symptoms and scans and simple tests that you can do through a virtual format. So I do think that technology has really enabled us to manage patients, both short and long-term effects, a lot better.
I think you're right with the virtual aspect. If the pandemic's taught us anything, how quickly we've advanced into, yeah, as you said, doing this podcast from across different sides of the world, sorry. I suppose one question would be then, when patients are maybe discharged and go back to their local service, and if it is further away, yes, they can link in with you virtually, but then how do you get the buy-in from the local team who potentially don't know anything about radiotherapy, or they might not know anything specifically about this type of radiotherapy?
Yeah, I think that's where we've made a really concerted effort in linking with all of those key referrers over time and making sure that we're available. Obviously, I'm speaking today, but you know, there's a big team of radiation oncologists, neurosurgeons that I work with. We are constantly engaging with our referrers and advising patients through their treating team locally. And over the years, it's really been an education piece with the local teams as to how to manage some of these side effects. And if they feel that they don't know, they know that they can just email. And so through these virtual interactions with patients, through regular contact with referrers, mainly via email and looking at scans, and I have to say, the cornerstone of our follow-up and management is our clinical nurse coordinator, who is our first point of contact on many occasions. We really have set up this team to really manage this over that wide geographic region.
We're quite lucky, Matt, through the podcast that we are being listened to in, I think, 108 countries across the world. If there are listeners from different countries that maybe don't have Gamma Knife or even considered it yet. Just going back to when you first implemented this in your area, what sort of things should they be considering or trying to build in that business case?
Look, I think to be completely upfront, you need to have to support the establishment of a Gamma Knife service, you need to have the appropriate case mix of work in a given location, and you need to have a certain catchment in terms of numbers of patients. There are many places where, to be honest, there are a range of non-Gamma Knife stereotactic solutions that may be appropriate. But I think that having the ability to have access to a Gamma Knife does open it up to a range of conditions that may not be as easily treated on a linear accelerator. So, for example, I have access to a range of technologies, both publicly and privately. There are still many patients that I would exclusively treat on the Gamma Knife because I genuinely think it is better. And I guess in terms of opening up that mix, it's things that we may not have spoken about on this podcast is the range of benign, vascular and functional conditions that a Gamma Knife can treat. I have to say, I treat more functional work than I do brain secondaries in public because my other colleagues treat the secondaries. But I treat a patient with trigeminal neuralgia, a painful facial syndrome, once a week. Now, when I went into radiation oncology, I never would have envisaged that I'm stepping outside of oncology. But a Gamma Knife does open up all of these non-oncologic indications. So getting back to your original question, Gamma Knife may not be the appropriate solution in all areas. It is a great machine when you have the appropriate case mix, but certainly for maybe smaller centres with a smaller catchment, linear accelerator-based solutions are definitely appropriate, but it may limit the case mix to maybe those malignant settings and some basic, less risky, benign settings, but certainly Gamma Knife has some advantages.
So is there anything that you think, from a patient perspective, that they should know about prior to maybe making a decision? And I don't know if maybe that decision is theirs to make in Australia. I know certainly in the UK, you know, patient choice does come into play and patients are maybe advocating for themselves. Is that something that happens in Australia, and how would you kind of support patients to say to their radiation oncologist, actually, am I eligible for stereotactic radiosurgery rather than maybe whole brain radiotherapy?
Yeah, I think that certainly through the course of my career, we've seen a major shift in patients. And look, I think it's great. I think any advice I have for patients is you need to be informed and ask questions. It would be great to think that the clinician in front of a given patient would be able to give them all of the range of options that are available, but often that's just not the case because they don't have access or they don't have understanding because through use or training can't really give that as an option to a patient. So I think it's really important that patients are informed, ask questions. I've always encouraged patients, if needs be, to seek another opinion and have time and come back if they want to. I certainly have seen in my career, and particularly in Australia, that patients are more informed and more involved in their decision making. They tell you who they want to see, and I think that that's only a good thing, working in partnership with our patients.
Matt, you're really lucky to have a really good working relationship with Elekta. What does that do for you as a radiation oncologist to be able to work with industry when you're implementing radiosurgery?
Look, I think having ties with industry is important. I think when you're setting up any service, you need to have good relationships with all stakeholders, and industry are one of those stakeholders. Now, I guess the advantages are many. I guess partly we will get visibility of things coming through. We can do the testing on that. We can actually be involved in refining some of the technology. And I think that that's kind of exciting, that you get involved in things at an early stage and can develop how they evolve. And I guess one of the things that I really enjoy in terms of the relationship that I have with the industry in particular, Lecter, is that we've set up a training facility through our centre, and they will link customers with us. And I love when customers come from all over the world to our site. We get to show them all of the stuff we do. We get to impart a lot of knowledge. It's just a great way to meet people from across the world, and we do it through education. I think it's great.
Thanks for the invite, Matt. We'll be there soon, hopefully.
Look forward to it.
Matt, are you involved in any research or projects? You know, what's the future for you going forwards?
Yeah, look, I have to say, given my various roles, some of the research now, I'm not as heavily involved firsthand, but certainly oversee a lot of it in our institution. I work with some amazing colleagues, some a bit younger than me and have a bit more enthusiasm, and they do exceptional work. And look, our group in Queensland at the Gavin Knife Centre in Queensland is churning out a lot of research. I think we're heavily interested in this preoperative space for brain metastases. The other area that we're very interested in is, as you know, there's a large number of drugs available now that have activity in the brain, and how we sequence radiosurgery with those drugs is a very exciting field and something of active research. I think areas that we have scope to expand into is some of that non-cancer work. I think that really, in terms of some of the benign conditions, radiotherapy in general and radiosurgery specifically is underutilized in many benign conditions. We are also seeing how radiosurgery can be used in a range of non-tumor indications. And you know, I'm sure some of your listeners have heard things about, you know, stereotactic ablation for heart arrhythmias, stereotactic treatment for abdominal pain where you treat the celiac plexus. Likewise, in the brain, there's a number of non-cancer conditions. So, for example, we regularly treat movement disorder patients. So these are patients with Parkinson's-like conditions where we target a specific area in the brain to help with their tremor. I mentioned trigeminal neuralgia. This is a standard approach. And there's actually some very interesting data, not in Australia, from other sites looking at treatment refractory obsessive compulsive disorder and using radiosurgery in that setting. So I have to say, in terms of where the field is moving, I think there's still a lot of work to be done in that brain metastasis setting in terms of pre-op versus post-op sequencing with drugs. I think there's a lot of work still to increase utilisation in the benign setting, but some of the really interesting research coming out is around that non-cancer space, which opens up new indications for radiosurgery in that non-cancer space.
It's very exciting to think that, you know, this is at the forefront of anything to do with the head. It's always been, you know, an area that people are a bit scared of, I think, sometimes when it comes to treatment or whatever, but you talked about the drug therapy. Is that, just for any patients listening, is that more targeted because it can go through the blood-brain barrier and then have kind of, I don't know, immune response or something like that within the area?
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, there's a number of cancers that do spread to the brain. And historically, it's been difficult to treat that because drugs could not get into the brain because of that blood-brain barrier. We now have a range of drugs, and these are not traditional chemotherapy agents. They're either targeted therapies or immune therapies that do have the ability to have impact within the brain. And in some cases, we're seeing exceptional responses in the brain just with drugs alone. I guess what's variable in that is some of them may not get a complete response. So there may be a role for radiosurgery to treat any residual tumours that don't go away completely. There may actually be a role in this immune environment using stereotactic treatment in the brain to induce a greater response to immune therapy, in fact, like priming the immune system by doing radiosurgery. So these are the areas where there's some really exciting work being done to look at how does radiosurgery fit in the spectrum. A lot of the data shows there's probably better done sooner rather than at salvage later, but how do we optimise outcomes for these patients that have drugs available, that have activity in the brain, and where does radiosurgery fit in the mix?
Matt, we're coming towards the end of the podcast. We always like to end with top tips for any patients, healthcare professionals listening. What can you give us?
Top tips. I think for patients listening, I think we've probably touched on it already. Be informed, ask questions, and feel free to see other specialists to get as much information as you can. I think that should be encouraged. In terms of clinicians, whether that be students, doctors, therapists, physicists, whoever's listening, it's kind of a little bit off topic from what we've been touching on, but I'm a really big advocate that if you want to provide the best service for your patients, you need to look after yourself first. And I guess this is something I think that maybe coming into mid-senior career, I've had a bit more time to reflect on it. And I think that as people working in this space, often our patients are distressed and at their most vulnerable. And we need to make sure that we're looking after our physical health, our mental health, and making sure that we do things like having appropriate holidays, having appropriate downtime, so that we can actually be the best that we can be to provide the best service for our patients. So I know that's completely off topic, but it's something that I feel quite strongly about. And it's something that is gaining a lot of momentum in Australia at the moment and elsewhere overseas. And I think that this is only a good thing for our patients if we can make sure that first and foremost, we're looking after our doctors. And I think that as a leader within healthcare and as a doctor in healthcare, it's kind of up to me and some of my colleagues to make sure that we make that shift for our junior colleagues.
Thank you. I don't think off topic at all, because it all ties into it. We can't deliver any sort of treatment or support for anyone without looking after ourselves first. So thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure. I've quite enjoyed it.
Well, thank you everyone for listening to Rad Chat. So your hosts today have been Numan Joker Anderson and Joe McNamara. If you're utilising this podcast for CPD purposes, please consider reflective questions posted along with the links to resources and literature that we've discussed. To receive your accredited CPD certificate, please complete the link with the podcast. So our next guest to feature will be Dr. Seth Mbili Ningidi and Dr. Mogawale Motobajane, who will be talking about their experience of radiosurgery in Africa. We would like to thank Elekta for this paid collaboration. Make sure you go to www.elekta.com to check out their products and services, and make sure to check out all the wonderful social media posts accompanying this series. Thank you for listening, and take care.